With COVID-19 cases rising in Puerto Rico, the island is struggling to test its residents.
Puerto Rico currently has the lowest per capita testing rate compared with any U.S. state.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, for Tuesday, April 28th, a look at how recent economic and political crises in Puerto Rico are affecting the island's ability to deal with the pandemic. Also, we continue with our series, speaking with local leaders around the country. We hear from Tampa Mayor Jane Castor. And how healthcare resources for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are controlled by geopolitics.
Essentially, everything that goes in and out of Gaza is controlled by an external authority, and primarily Israel. So this not only means the movement of people going in and out, but also the supplies that can be sent to Gaza, such as medicine or equipment or ventilators.
And we round out the show with a conversation on the massive pressure to be productive as we sit in isolation. All right, let's get started. This week, a growing number of countries are starting to relax the measures they put in place to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus, even as the global number of confirmed cases surpasses 3 million. In Europe, children in Spain can now go outside after 6 weeks of lockdown restrictions, while in Italy, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte unveiled his plan to reopen the economy next week. Here in the U.S., Texas is letting its stay-at-home order expire on Thursday. In Georgia and Tennessee, some restaurants have welcomed back dine-in customers for the first time in weeks. And in Washington, one of the country's early hotspots, the state government will reopen recreation areas to the public next week. Still, in some places, strict lockdown measures will remain in place for the foreseeable future, including in Puerto Rico, where the government is lagging behind the rest of the U.S. in testing for COVID-19.
Puerto Rico currently has the lowest per capita testing rate compared with any U.S. state. Less than 1% of the population has been tested.
That's Donica Cotto, a correspondent for the Associated Press covering the Caribbean, based in San Juan. There have been around 1,400 confirmed cases in Puerto Rico so far, with the few tests that have been administered. Though some officials praised the island last month for its aggressive social distancing measures, experts are now saying its testing capacity has likely skewed the reality of the outbreak. All the while, Puerto Rico is still grappling with the aftermath of some devastating financial and political turmoil over the last couple of years, including the island's bankruptcy and Hurricane Maria. The population of Puerto Rico is also older and poorer compared with elsewhere in the U.S., making it even more vulnerable should it reopen too soon. For more on this, we spoke with the AP's Donica Cotto, as well as Nicole Acevedo, a digital reporter for NBC News. And I asked Donica what the Puerto Rican government was doing now to ramp up its testing capacity.
The government recently has distributed about 100,000 testing kits to municipalities, in addition to more testing kits to the National Guard, performing those tests at the airport. Part of the concern is that there's about a $38 million contract that was scrapped several weeks ago, in which the government was going to buy about a million testing kits, and that was later discarded because in part, the government said they weren't going to arrive on time. And then later on, amid ongoing testimony as part of an investigation into this contract, it turns out that the company that was going to supply these testing kits seems to have ties to the ruling party in Puerto Rico. So there's a lot of concern about this. And overall, critics say that time was lost. You know, when they started this contract, they could have gotten testing kits elsewhere. And, you know, as many other countries around the world, I mean, Puerto Rico is still trying to track down more testing kits.
Nicole, can you talk through kind of how local governments and different municipalities are responding to this, particularly when there's some confusion around sort of testing from the central government? And I guess what kinds of social distancing measures are, you know, in place and what kind of effect they've been having?
Mayors in the towns across Puerto Rico have had to sort of figure out their own plan of action when at the central government level, not a lot of testing is being done or distributed to them. So many of them have created mini task force of their own with professionals that live right on their town. For instance, in the town of Ponce, they did that and they started their first drive-through testing site. And that's how they were starting to get some data. And whenever they had a positive case, they would try to do some contact tracing in order to be able to isolate people in communities and avoid spread.
Nicole, have they been effective, the mayors, in encouraging people to, you know, follow social distancing?
The governor of Puerto Rico put out a curfew that was very strict right off the bat, unlike many other jurisdictions in the United States. And that seems to have been very effective in minimizing the spread and flattening the curve. We're getting reports from mayors and other local leaders that the hospitals in the island are actually not overwhelmed. So in the beginning, enforcing the curfew was a little bit iffy. I think people were having some sort of trouble adjusting to that new normality. But once the curfew that was already strict got even more strict, I think that's when people started to realize, oh, wow, this is actually very serious. And for the most part, it seems that people and crowds have been able to be controlled around communities in the island.
You know, Donica, to link those two things, if you're trying to encourage social distancing, but you don't have a full picture from testing of kind of how bad things are, has that limited the government's ability to say, hey, guys, you know, we really need to be locking things down right now?
Very much so. I mean, the government yesterday talked a little bit about a plan, a draft. Nothing has been approved yet, but it's a draft that calls for a gradual lifting of the lockdown. So this draft visualizes construction, manufacturing, and agronomy sort of reopening first, followed by, in a second phase, by government agencies, real estate industry, transportation. Then next to last would be restaurants, retail, trade, professional technical services. But, you know, the battle right now is health versus economy. And Puerto Rico is in the middle of a 13-year recession. It's still trying to recover from Hurricane Maria. It's still trying to recover from the string of recent strong earthquakes in late December and January that caused millions of dollars in damage. So before this hit, Puerto Rico was already in a very fragile economic state.
Yeah.
So right now, you know, there's people saying we need to reopen businesses. And part of the problem is that the lockdown, people would not reject the lockdown as much if they were receiving the money that was promised, both local and federal funds. But since those are still trickling in, there's sort of more pressure placed on the government on behalf of some businesses and some economists saying, look, we need to reopen something because otherwise, you know, we're going to have an unemployment rate of 37% in upcoming weeks.
I'm going to get to the government funding question in a second, but I want to get a sense of how the medical service universe looks right now. Nicole, you've done some reporting on this. How are hospitals doing right now? Are there enough physicians and medical staff to take care of people?
Even on a normal day in Puerto Rico, what the data shows is that whatever it's available in the island, it's not enough to serve the health needs of the population of the people in Puerto Rico. That's almost like a known thing in the island. Hmm. And that seems to be kind of the point of departure when making decisions about this pandemic, right? For instance, putting the lockdown in place so early and really trying to flatten that curve, really what ended up happening was that hospitals were empty, essentially. Like I was saying, we were having reports from many municipalities saying our hospitals are not full with people, we're not getting anybody. And in some instances, some hospitals started to lay off people or cut down on staff. And what ended up happening was that a lot of those people were being recruited in places like New Jersey and New York that were seeing a spike in cases at the time. Puerto Rico doesn't know where they're at in the curve. So in the event that they're not at the peak of contagion in the island, and hospitals get more traffic and more people needing services, they might not actually have the staff or the equipment they need.
Donica, let's talk about the money here. This weekend, the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Julín Cruz, told MSNBC that no one on the island had gotten a $1,200 coronavirus stimulus check. What do we know about that?
That's correct. About nearly 500,000 people over the weekend began receiving notice of their eligibility for the $1,200 federal incentive. So part of the problem is it appears that the federal government still has to approve how that will be distributed. So Puerto Rico's government says it has submitted a plan for that. And it appears that the disagreement is the local government wants the U.S. to do a direct deposit, but the U.S. says Puerto Rico's Treasury Department should distribute it. So we're sort of in holding mode, waiting to see what the U.S. government, you know, will decide on how this $1,200 will be distributed. Meanwhile, they announced that this weekend the $600 weekly for the unemployed via CARES Act will be available. And in addition, the $2.2 billion that will be available to Puerto Rico's government, that they have not decided how exactly they will use that yet. There's a federal control board that oversees Puerto Rico's finances. Right. And so they advised, you know,
from the bankruptcy.
Correct. And they recently advised over the weekend, they suggested that the government should invest in the health system, you know, like buy more protective equipment, prepare for a possible resurgence, do more contact tracing, boost the education system, help the unemployed and the shuttered businesses. So on the local side, the government has promised, you know, bonuses and incentives. So about more than 140,000 self-employed workers in Puerto Rico have sought a $500 incentive, and nearly all of them have received it. However, only half of the more than 200,000 people seeking unemployment assistance has received benefits. The Department of Labor, the one in Puerto Rico, has said, we're overwhelmed, we're working, you know, more hours, we're trying to help more people, as much people as possible, but right now, we're a bit overwhelmed. So the money is coming in, but, you know, people are getting desperate. They were already, you know, most of them were already in dire economic straits before the coronavirus hit. So every day, you know, we see new messages saying, please help us. We haven't received this money.
I want to talk about kids on the island for a second. Nicole, you've done a lot of reporting on the education system, which was already dealing with significant school closures in the previous governor's administration. What are the big challenges right now facing families as they've tried to shift to remote learning, especially in parts of the island that are rural or underserved?
I mean, you're having, like many, many other places, that these kids and these school systems have to shift into remote learning very quickly, almost immediately. And when you don't have an infrastructure that can really take on that transition, a lot of kids will get lost in the middle. So in the rural areas, a lot of the kids there don't have access to internet or a computer. We're talking about at least 56%, according to the Puerto Rico Youth Institute. And that's a lot. That's more than half of your kids in the public school system. And on top of that, you have to add, you know, the other stressors that come with just being in the middle of the pandemic in Puerto Rico. A lot of these parents have lost jobs, have to close their small businesses. A lot of these kids will not have a full experience learning and having sort of a normal semester. That gets more complicated for kids that lived in the southern towns of Puerto Rico that have been affected by the earthquakes earlier this year. Mm-hmm. A lot of those kids have not stepped in a classroom since January because after the earthquakes, all the schools closed down and inspections were being done to make sure that their structures were safe.
Danica Cotto is a correspondent for the Associated Press covering the Caribbean, and Nicole Acevedo is a digital reporter for NBC News. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Continue now on our series of conversations with local leaders nationwide about how they're handling the pandemic in their cities. Today, we head to Florida, where the state's stay-at-home order is set to expire on May 1st. That's in 3 days. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said the state is flattening the curve as he looks towards slowly reopening. Tampa Mayor Jane Castor took early action in her city before statewide stay-at-home orders came down. And she joins us to explain what things look like now as the state makes moves to reopen. Mayor Castor, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with your safer at home order for Hillsborough County. You were pretty vocal about wanting to implement the order before the state did. Has there been any tension between state and local responses?
You know, I don't know about tension as much as passion. It's difficult for me. I have to look out for the health and well-being of our citizens first and foremost. And so we by far are the most densely populated area in the entire county. You know, I wanted to get orders put in place very quickly, and there was some resistance to that, but it was done in a timely fashion. As far as the state, we really haven't had a lot of direction on a statewide level. The governor has left it up to the cities and counties to find their way.
Yeah, the governor, Ron DeSantis, a Republican, and you're a Democrat, we should mention. What is your response to his plans to reopen the state?
As long as decisions are made on the science and we're able to get appropriate levels of testing, I think that decisions that are made with the data that comes from the testing, contact tracing, and then being able to see who has the antibodies and can go back out into the workforce. As long as decisions are made in that way as opposed to popularity, I think that we'll do fine.
Except that I've heard you say that the testing is nowhere near adequate to be able to make those decisions.
The problem wasn't so much the testing, it was the collection. We didn't have the collection kits. So now we have ample supply of the collection kits, and we have opened four more testing sites in our community. One is from a hospital, and then all of those are drive-through, and then all of our area hospitals are testing a number of private medical facilities are testing. Now it seems that we may be hitting a problem, hitting a wall with the actual testing ability itself.
But, you know, antibody tests are still a real open question in terms of their efficacy. Do you have a sense of what the metrics would be for you to say, okay, I feel all right with some of these places opening?
I don't know that I'll be able to say that because I believe that it's going to be forced on us. And, you know, as long as it is a sort of a slow turn on of the economy and opening back up, as opposed to just, you know, turning the spigot on full force, then we will be able to pull back if necessary.
Forced on you by the governor?
By the president, by the governor, you know, whoever makes the ultimate decision that I won't be able to go against. It has to be incremental so that if it, you know, indications are that you may be moving too rapidly, you can dial it back. But we're going to have the testing. We're going to have the antibody testing, you know, as good as it can get. We can't let perfect get in the way of good. We've got to move ahead with this testing and then ensuring that we're protecting those that are the most vulnerable. You know, ensuring that we have our nursing homes covered, making sure that we're able to trace the contacts of individuals, ensuring that we can identify our hot zones and then get rapid services into those locations to tamp it back down.
We have already seen tension between communities of color and cops around mask wearing. It's something we've covered on this show, including a doctor who was handcuffed in Miami. I wonder what kind of conversations and guidance are you having and giving to the police in Tampa right now?
What we have done is to try to address that through social media and to try to get those individuals in the community that are respected in particular neighborhoods to point out the importance, the significance of wearing the facial covering, and then the consequences of not doing that. You know, you have a lot in some neighborhoods, there's multi-generational housing. And so the young, invincible kids unknowingly can take that back in and infect those family members that can least afford to have this virus. So that's the message that we're trying to get out there. And we're trying to get it out in a very positive way.
But you understand why some people, black men in particular, might be reticent to wear a mask when they see the kind of things like have happened in Miami.
Yeah, that Yes, I do. I do. I fully understand that. But, you know, the mask wearing is going to be that is going to be a new normal for all of us. So I do understand that. And that's something that we have to deal with as a society. And that comes through continuous communication.
This is certainly a lot of pressure for someone in power right now. How are you doing on a personal level?
You know, it is, but that's why you're in these positions, is to lead. And that's what the community looks for. They look for someone who is going to lead, who is going to be transparent, who's going to give them the information, good or bad, just give them the straightforward information, and then have a plan in place that can be followed. But I tell, you know, every day I let the citizens know that first and foremost, my number one responsibility is the health and well-being of our community. And the economy is critically important, but I've got to make sure that everyone is safe and healthy first and foremost.
Before I let you go, Tampa has got a new pretty high-profile resident, Tom Brady, who just moved there. I hear he's not exactly getting a pass when it comes to social distancing. What happened?
He was out for a run. We've closed down our parks, and he apparently went out for a run and then went into one of the parks close to where he's staying to stretch out. And so one of our parks employees just let him know that the park was closed at that time. So as I said, no harm, no foul.
Tampa, Florida Mayor Jane Castor, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. We really appreciate it. Take care.
Over the past few weeks, we've adapted much of our daily life to isolation. And it hasn't been easy. Many of us are trying to figure out how to work from home while juggling parenting and maintaining our social relationships without actually being able to meet people face to face. But one of the most difficult things to adapt to in this strange new world of isolation is loss and grief, whether or not death is the result of COVID-19. WNYC, which produces The Takeaway, lost a member of our staff last week. Richard Hake, host of WNYC's Morning Edition, died last Friday of natural causes. Before hosting Morning Edition, Richard was the voice New Yorkers heard on The Takeaway for the better part of a decade. But we know we're not alone in this struggle. So we asked you, our listeners, to share stories of loss with us in hopes that by sharing our grief together, we'll all feel just a little bit less alone.
Hi, my name's Amy Collins. I live in Johnston, Rhode Island. My mother died March 30th. Not COVID-related as far as we know, totally unexpected. And it's been surreal and bizarre to grieve her loss in the midst of lockdown. I last saw her the last Friday that schools were open. I went to visit my parents, and we didn't hug that day because of the virus. So we blew kisses from across the room at each other. We can't have a funeral. It's surreal. It's totally surreal because it feels like the whole world is grieving with me. She was a remarkable woman, and we just live in a terrible time. So, but we've gotten through worse as a country, and hopefully we'll come through this stronger and more compassionate to one another.
My name is Paula, and I live in Newark, Delaware. One of my friends took his life in early April. Grieving and mourning his death has been a much different experience than any other losses. I can't give or get hugs. His loved ones have not been able to come together to celebrate his life, and that makes it all a bit surreal. I have his obituary open in my browser. I see it every day. I don't want his life and death to go unnoticed just because it happened during a pandemic. He was a wonderful person. We all miss him very much.
This is Elizabeth Scully calling from Cleveland, Ohio. My son was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive bone cancer right before Thanksgiving. Only a week after, he and his wife found out that she was pregnant. I am on my way down to the hospital in Cleveland to say goodbye to my granddaughter, who was born 2 months early with a variety of health issues. And I just feel so sad that everybody can't come together.
We'll continue our conversation on grief with a tribute to Richard Hake tomorrow, and a conversation about managing grief in this unique time. And in the meantime, if you're struggling with grief and need help or just someone to talk to, you can reach the National Mental Health Association at 1-800-969-6642. You can also find more resources through the Grief Resource Network. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We go now to the Middle East, where COVID-19 is threatening an already strained healthcare system for Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. In those areas, Palestinian officials have reported nearly 500 cases and just 2 deaths. So far, pre-existing security restrictions have played a role in preventing a more rapid spread of the virus in Palestinian communities.
My hometown, it's called Mukhmas. It's in counted as in East Jerusalem. It has one entrance and you can easily try to control it. So thank God until now, zero cases we have.
That's Dr. Motaz Abdullah Siam. Dr. Siam works at clinics in both East and West Jerusalem and says that they've developed clear protocols for dealing with possible COVID-19 cases.
We are prepared for any patient with coronavirus. We try not to have any patients with fever or shortness of breath or any signs or symptoms with related to coronavirus. And we try to manage them on telephone and then direct them either to come for a physical examination or go to a hospital. Or now in East and West Jerusalem, of course, we have the ambulances who go to the house of the patient and they check him right there to decrease the susceptibility for health workers.
But Dr. Siam also points out that the healthcare system in East Jerusalem looks very different from the one in West Jerusalem.
On one hand, we have governmental and private sector hospitals in West Jerusalem compared to charitable hospitals in East Jerusalem. In certain areas, we have shortage as far as no gloves and no gowns. In certain areas, the situation is still under control.
And while the coronavirus outbreak does appear to be under control in the Palestinian territories and East Jerusalem, Dr. Siam says that the Israeli government has not been proactive in protecting Palestinians.
The Israeli government prohibits Palestinians from all kinds of activities in East Jerusalem, not only medical. We can mention also political, social, cultural, you name it. And until late in time in this pandemic, few to no precautious measures were taken to prevent the spread to the Arabic community in East Jerusalem, which could have been vital in that period. Keeping in mind lack of cases in East Jerusalem until late time, until the past month.
For Dr. Siam, the need for assistance right now transcends political conflicts.
During pandemics, it's not elective to help other governments, to help other needy persons. From my point of view, it's crucial that we can get, not only us, all the countries, all the needy countries in the world. It's crucial to get the aid to encounter this pandemic. If not now, like when?
Amjad Iraqi is an editor at 972 Magazine, an online news outlet covering Israeli and Palestinian issues. He's also a policy analyst for Al-Shabaka, a nonpartisan think tank focused on Palestinian human rights. And he told me there's been some sharing of medical supplies and information between the Israeli and Palestinian governments, But he also pointed out that in East Jerusalem, the Palestinian government has been blocked from stepping in directly.
The Palestinian Authority wants to assist these hospitals in East Jerusalem, but the Israeli authorities are refusing to allow that to happen. They see it as illegal political activity as the Palestinians try to assert some kind of influence in the city, which the Israelis regard as their own, quote unquote, eternal undivided capital. So you end up having a situation whereby you have these hospitals that are neglected and underfunded and under-resourced, with the Israeli authorities not really caring enough about them, while also blocking the Palestinian authorities that are able to provide what little support they have to it. Essentially, everything that goes in and out of Gaza is controlled by an external authority, and primarily Israel. So this not only means the movement of people going in and out, but also the supplies that can be sent to Gaza, such as medicine or equipment or ventilators. In the West Bank, it doesn't have the same blockade, but it's still placed under numerous occupation restrictions. Again, the crossings are also controlled by Israel, including military checkpoints, which are run by Israel, which also monitors goods coming in and out. Then you also have, for example, certain trade agreements that were signed since the Oslo Accords in the 1990s, such as the Paris Protocol, which basically means that all imports and exports, including of medical supplies and other basic necessities and things that could help Palestinian hospitals in normal times, let alone during a pandemic, that all of these have to go through Israeli regulations, additional Israeli tax authorities. Sometimes the PA has to actually overpay for even basic medicines to supply to its people, and it's not according to the PA's time, that it's the Israeli authorities that in the end decide when to process and et cetera. And then, of course, you have the wider structural difficulties in, you know, it's everything from Palestinians who have to worry about being evicted or having their homes demolished. In Gaza, the fact that the blockade has essentially made it impossible to keep proper public sanitation in numerous communities, that the water itself can't go through the filtering process that it needs to make sure that you have clean drinking water. In fact, the vast majority of drinking water in Gaza is not healthy for consumption. And this is just a few examples of how, you know, even the basic necessities that you can't get by to ensure your own health.
You know, so many of the things that you are listing and the conditions that we see in the West Bank and Gaza are sort of ingredients for a pandemic to spread quickly. Limited access to medicines, close living territory, sanitation issues, like you've just mentioned, with water. And yet the case toll so far seems relatively low. Do we have any sense of what explains that?
I mean, part of it is the fact that both the Palestinian authorities in the West Bank and Gaza acted extremely quickly. They both have very strong executive powers and security forces, at least insofar as the areas that they're concerned. In the occupied West Bank, 60% of that territory is actually under Israel's control, and about 35 to 40% is controlled by the Palestinian government. And within those pockets, the fact that the government can kind of deploy its forces means that you know, the health ministry directives that they have, oftentimes in cooperation with Israeli authorities as well, can be implemented very quickly and effectively.
The WHO and the Red Cross have sent some medical supplies into Gaza to help with the pandemic. Has that been helpful at all? Do we know?
In the end, these are only going to be very short-term, very small measures. In the end, this is equipment that will run out very quickly and it can only be used for a limited population. And in the end, humanitarian aid is not the solution for it. It's a plaster, but it's not the solution. In the end, these Palestinians, that they need the ability to kind of control what they can purchase, when they can move these equipments and the basic medical supplies, to be able to freely move patients, especially from Gaza, where it's almost impossible to get a medical permit, let alone a medical permit in time to get to a hospital that is properly equipped. Without those basic freedoms, without those basic liberties to take those decisions and to access the world fully, without the Israeli authorities putting numerous obstacles, any support that comes from international organizations just won't be enough.
Well, just last week, we saw Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his main political opponent there, Benny Gantz, form a unity government. Do we have any sense of how that may affect Palestinians and their ability to get hospital care or aid?
In the end, it won't really affect it. For all the political differences that are between the Prime Minister Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, they're quite united in many respects about how to think about and engage with the Palestinian people. And just a prime example of this, when in the coalition agreement that was signed just last week, one of the prime subjects that they had raised was actually not about how to tackle COVID-19, you know, effectively in Israel, or let alone even the occupied territories. One of the core components was to say that we actually want to annex huge parts of the occupied West Bank into the Israeli state. These are areas of the West Bank where you have Israeli settlements, almost exclusively for Jewish citizens, where the Israeli authorities have control over Palestinian natural resources, including farmlands and agriculture. This has been a long time objective for numerous Israeli authorities. These areas have been under de facto annexation for years, for decades, but now they just want to kind of make it official with the law to give that stamp. So what that's showing us, among many other examples, is that for Israeli politicians, the Palestinians are not people to help. They're not people to assist. It's the question of what can we take from the Palestinians in the meantime, while this pandemic is distracting the world, is distracting Palestinians, to give the advantage to the state. It's a very hostile take on how we should be perceiving the occupied territories, not a matter of aid. And that will continue.
Amjad Araki is an editor at 972 Magazine. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Round out the hour today by talking about another piece of our coronavirus reality, the pressure to get stuff done in this moment. Now, the pressure for self-improvement, productivity is nothing new, but during this pandemic, a lot of people are bombarded with articles featuring tips for staying productive during quarantine, endless social media posts about our friends' new love of homemade sourdough bread, and reminders about the huge achievements by Shakespeare and Newton when they were quarantined hundreds of years ago. But hang on, those comparisons can be really damaging. It's hard enough to deal with the everyday mental strains of life during a pandemic without having to feel inadequate for not taking up a new hobby or religiously doing home workouts. Joining us now to talk about why we feel the need to be productive during this time and why it's okay not to be is Taylor Lorenz, a technology reporter at The New York Times who covers internet culture, and David Bluestein, a counseling psychology professor at the Boston College Lynch School of Education and Human Development. Thank you both for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
David, first off, sort of on a psychological level, how can living through something like this affect our ability to get through the day? You know, from a mental health perspective, some people say they feel more tired, less focused. Is that normal?
Absolutely. The pandemic is actually a highly stressful state. I mean, we all know that. And the idea that working from home or being at home for an indefinite period of time, that being a kind of comfortable space, on one level, that is accurate. But the reality is the world outside of us has changed dramatically. Many of the crises that we're facing are interconnected: loss of life, loss of the illusion of health, loss of work, loss of relational contact with others. This is not a typical normal state of affairs. So working from home is actually a very stressful experience at this point, having our children home. And the expectations that you noted earlier are in many ways very unrealistic. The psychological energy required to maintain ourselves, to maintain our capacity to be caring toward ourselves, toward others, it takes a tremendous amount of energy.
It seems, anecdotally at least, that this pressure seems to affect more people who are not essential workers and who are not parents, sort of trying to teach school at home. David, does what you are seeing reflect that stratification?
Yes. I think what we're seeing actually is work has always been a place where inequality has been most apparent. And this inequality has become much, much more clear during these last few months. We have people who are working remotely, and that's kind of become part of the media narrative. Mm-hmm. But we also have people who are out of work. Millions of people in this country are out of work. We have other millions of people who are seriously in danger of losing their jobs. And then we have the essential workers. So we really have a multifaceted nature of work at this point, and it's really hard to generalize. But everyone is facing the same multiple crises at the same time.
Taylor, you cover internet culture and this kind of social media narrative that we could be doing something more productive outside of work. How do you see that manifest online?
Yeah, well, I think social media is all about sharing what you're doing and seeing what other people are doing. So I think a lot of people have felt like, you know, they log on to Instagram and they see their friend, for instance, cooking a home-cooked meal or baking bread or doing that workout push-up challenge, you know, and tagging their friends. And it makes them feel like they're not living up to it, you know, that they aren't being as productive or getting as much done as their friends on social media are.
Did people tell you why they felt like they were struggling with these feelings? What did they tell you when you were doing your reporting on these issues?
Well, one thing that a lot of people said is that it was really hard to log off. I think that the boundaries between work time and home time have been completely obliterated. You know, a lot of us rely on platforms like Slack or chat messaging, email. These are all things that make it really hard to log off at the end of the day. And we have our cell phones, you know, into the night. So I think a lot of people are working longer hours than ever. And they're just more responsive to their phones now than ever because they're stuck at home.
David, where psychologically does this pressure come from? This sort of need both to keep up with other people, but also to feel like we are trying to be our best selves in the middle of something terrible.
I think it's a complicated kind of set of challenges. First off, many people in our culture do live with these expectations of achievement and accomplishment. That's kind of part of the kind of postmodern narrative about work. I think that needs to be reinvented. I think that this crisis gives us an opportunity to rethink how we engage in work, how we engage in relationships. I actually believe that this push toward more and more achievement needs to be revisited in a very dramatic way. This crisis is teaching us a lot of lessons. I mean, some of the lessons are ones we'd rather not have learned, which is it's shattering the illusion of safety and health. But I also believe that we have an opportunity to rethink how we engage in work and to pull back on this intense desire for achievement, and also the idea of kind of competing with others, which I believe is kind of evoked by social media. Hmm. And also by, you know, these different stories of people baking bread, Chris Cuomo coming on CNN with 101 fever. I mean, these are not good models for us, really. I mean, I respect Chris Cuomo a lot, but I do think that people do need to take a break. People need to be compassionate toward themselves and toward others. I think our goal is to survive this and to maintain our relationships and help these relationships grow, but not to push ourselves so much.
Taylor, how does this shake out generationally? Because obviously millennials get tagged with a lot of things, but thinking structurally, people who are millennials and younger graduated from school into an uncertain economy. They're now living through a pandemic. Do you think this is stratified by age?
It's absolutely stratified by age. You know, I spoke to this woman, Ann Helen Peterson, who's writing a book on millennial burnout. And millennials, like you said, they don't all have kids yet, but some of them do have young kids who are at home. It's sometimes their first child. They're feeling this intense pressure to do everything right, to do everything perfect. A lot of other millennials are still, you know, young enough. They're not totally married, but they're just getting on their feet. So, you know, they're not in that point in their career where they can kind of log off for a little, or, you know, they're kind of struggling to make it. Some of them are working in the gig economy. It's very stressful. And, you know, this is millennials' second recession, you know, in their young adult lives. So I think it's all very overwhelming for them in particular. That doesn't mean that it's not just as stressful, you know, for a lot of older generations in different ways. But for millennials, I think this is hitting harder. They're also more connected to technology. You know, millennials, it's harder for them to log off. They spend more time on social media. And they spend more time on their phones. So it's, you know, it's all of those feelings are really coming up.
Flipping this around a little bit, David, you know, are there benefits to making the sourdough starter or trying to, I don't know, draw more, read more? Is there value in trying to cultivate things that you wouldn't necessarily have the time for in normal life?
Absolutely. And I think people are using this time as an opportunity to kind of do things differently. I guess my main message is that there is no one right way to go through a pandemic. People have to find their own way through it. And yeah, for some people, trying new things is going to be wonderful. Baking bread. For me, I'm doing different kinds of writing projects. I find that actually very meaningful. And those can be very adaptive ways to manage the anxiety and stress of this period. Work serves as an important psychological aspect of our lives, as do leisure activities, as do relationships. So we each need to find our own pathway through this. And I think that's really critical. And I think one of the big takeaways here is going to be for people to just kind of relax, figure out what works for them, discuss it with their families and friends, but really look deep into themselves and find their own way of making meaning in this new reality.
Taylor, you and I and people like us maybe have played a role in some of this. Why do you think so many media outlets feel this need to say, oh, here's what you can do with your quarantine free time?
Well, I think people like to read these articles. People want to, you know, read about all the things that they could do. It's inspiring. And I think it, you know, encourages people to, you know, maybe take up that hobby or project. And but I do think that there was kind of this overwhelming amount of articles right after the pandemic hit that I think stressed a lot of people out.
And maybe sort of the suggestion that you would have now is what?
Well, my suggestion for media companies might be to give people a little bit more like how-tos, you know, not necessarily frame things as 10 things to get done in quarantine, but more, you know, here's how to cut your own bangs if you want to, or how to needlepoint if you want to, and not necessarily like encourage people to try to be so productive in this time.
Taylor Lorenz is a technology reporter at The New York Times covering internet culture. And David Bluestein is a counseling psychology professor at the Boston College Lynch School of Education and Human Development. Thank you both very much for joining me.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Kathy Gregg from Chicago. And I navigate the feelings of not being productive enough by avoiding social media where everyone's doing these cute things or singing to Stephen Sondheim or whatever it is that they're doing from home that just make me feel like I'm not good enough. And I've taken up doing painting, even though I'm not a painter by any means. Just things that are things that I've always wanted to do in downtime, and just, I guess, keeping my own counsel on what productiveness is. And when I don't feel it, trying not to be guilty.
Hi, my name is Larry. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm 74 years old and I'm a musician. I've been playing music and connecting with people with music all of my life. I've been going out on my back deck. I've been just playing music, just singing from my porch 4 days a week. And if people want to come and listen, they do. I feel like I'm doing something good, spreading some joy, putting a good vibe out into the universe during this dark time.
I've had a little practice fighting feelings of needing to be productive for a couple of years now in reading about capitalism and what it does to our brains and our hearts. So I feel a little bit prepared for this and have really been leaning into not doing anything at all and find that I'm still doing so much, and letting that go has been really nice, hard, but nice. And I hope that everybody else is able to do what they need to do to feel sane. This is Caitlin calling from the Vineyard.
All across America, this is The Takeaway.
A final note, today is the 12th anniversary of the first broadcast of The Takeaway.
Well, now it's actually 6 a.m. and we're ready. It's Monday, April 28th.
And despite the pandemic, some of the headlines that day in 2008 don't feel so very different from some much more recent ones.
More talk of race and the push for the Democratic presidential nomination. Today, the checks are in the mail to stimulate your wallet.
It has been a wild ride, and 12 years later, we're so grateful to be with you every day. Thank you for listening. And happy birthday, Takeaway family. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.